Yeah, welcome back to Coast AM. And we're talking with Dane Wigginton. The show is about geoengineering and the astonishing reality of how governments and corporations have been doing these experiments with the weather. Crazy things. Shocking things. Things that might keep you up at night. And I'm glad that you are, because we had just a great question from one of our callers, Jeff in Houston. And let's bring it back on. And Dane, you're still there, right?
Yes, sir.
Do you remember the question that he asked, or should I get him to...
I remembered several. Okay. If I could get back, and I can answer one more of those right now. I think this might be the key one you're talking about. But
yeah, for people who might not have heard it, let me bring him back on. Okay. Jeff, you still there?
Yes.
Okay, ask your question again, because it was a real doozy.
Okay, well, it was, there are already machines that use radio frequency to shake the rock strata in the earth.
Oh, no, that's your follow-up. No, your first question.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, their first biological, yeah.
Oh, about the strontium 90?
Yeah, because if you say that again, for people who might not have been with us the last break, we're talking about these chemicals that people are finding in the atmosphere. Go ahead.
Right. I was asking about the barium and the aluminum, or about the...
Yes, about the coating of them with fiberglass. Yeah.
Right. I was wondering if they were any evidence that they were coating the chemicals with fiberglass so that they could more easily slip into the human body.
Go ahead.
Okay. Go ahead.
Well, given the particle size we're talking about, if that technology exists, we haven't seen it. Given the patent statement of the particle size in question, we're talking about a particle that is exponentially smaller than anything tested for, a particle that is so small in the nanometer range that, again, according to internationally recognized neuroscientists like Dr. Russell Blaylock, enters right through the lung lining, goes straight into the bloodstream, where it adheres to cell receptors like a plaque, also helps cross the blood-brain barrier. Also, you have synergistic toxicity. All of these metals are highly toxic in and of themselves. When you combine them, toxicity increases radically. In fact, we have studies in the case of aluminum and mercury. We all have mercury in us. We all now have aluminum in us. With studies with lab rats, enough mercury to kill 1 in 100 lab rats combined with enough aluminum to kill 1 in 100 lab rats, all the lab rats die. That's an increase in toxicity of nearly 10,000%. Also, Rob, on the break, I heard the discussion of autism, and nobody knows what it is. Well, we have a pretty damn good idea. If we look at the mathematical fact of how much metal is falling on us, the known association between this metal and the triggering or affectation of autism, and we have an increase, statistical increase, in the case of autism in the last 50 years, as these programs have been ramped up, of 10,000%, from 1 in 5,000 in the late 70s to 1 in 50 as of the latest report. Dementia and Alzheimer's, as of April of last year, 1 in 3 seniors now dies with dementia and or Alzheimer's. Doesn't die from it, but dies with it. So, again, all these dots connect. And the last question, or one of the questions that the caller had, was about the, you know, being able to detonate or trigger seismic activity with a seafloor detonation. But I want to read you something quick off the MIT Technology Review. This is a highly regarded global scientific manual in regard to the Fukushima quake. And I quote verbatim from their study. Before the M9 earthquake, the total electron content of the ionosphere increased dramatically over the epicenter, reaching a maximum 3 days before the quake struck. At the same time, satellite observations showed a big increase in infrared emissions from above the epicenter, which peaked in the hours before the quake. In other words, the atmosphere was heating up. I quote verbatim. And in regard to the frequencies, Rob, as we spoke before the break too, this is from the Stanford VLF group. Quote, the VLF group focuses on using HARP to generate ELF and VLF waves through a process called modulated heating. Such experiments have been conducted since 99. This is from the Stanford VLF group and MIT Technology Review. Highly recognized scientific sources.
Mm. Jeff, does that answer your questions?
Yes, but I would also like, if the government is using this for our benefit, I wish they'd just come out and explain how they're doing it. Mm. I know that Don Grassley in Iowa said if the contrails or chemtrails do reflect a lot of the sun, you know, that helps the corn crops because they're not going to get scorched in the summer. if it holds the heat in overnight, then that helps warm up the area. A lot of this geoengineering, it seems to me, is highly localized, and that's why it's so difficult to say that the whole world's climate is changing, because like you said earlier, over the eastern part of the U.S., we have certain things, but they're causing droughts other places. You know, obviously, we wouldn't want to cause droughts here. And if we can get the jet stream to change, we'll maybe pull some of that cool air down during the summer instead of the winter. And also, like when Hurricane Katrina came, I figured that the Air Force was going to drop a MOAB on the eye wall, and that way it would dissipate the hurricane back down to a tropical storm or a depression. I don't know why they wouldn't do it. You know,
there's a major point of contention. If I could mention the caller, there's a major point of contention I would have, and that's this. I think you're operating with the notion that these programs are meant for the common good for the American public, and I would argue that point. We have enough data to really refute that, and so, again, I see nothing benevolent in these programs. You are correct, exactly correct, that they trap as much or more radiant heat as they deflect. They shred the ozone layer, which allows more thermal energy to penetrate. Disruption of the hydrological cycle, which is causing the forest around the globe to burn down. In recent years, nearly 100 million acres per year in Siberia. The negative effects of these programs so far outweigh any perceived positive effect that I think it's safe to say at this point there is no benevolence in these programs. None.
Jeff, you had quickly, what was your question about strontium?
Well, we know that strontium 90, the body can't differentiate between that and calcium. They used to put it in kids' milk back in the 50s to test on it. And I was just wondering if there's any evidence that that's being sprayed also, because like you mentioned, once it's aerosolized, it can be absorbed very rapidly through the skin or lungs, and it would be in our bones, and it would take decades to get rid of. So if they wanted to use HARP ELF against it, you know, it'd be very easy.
Now, in the case of strontium, we know that strontium 90 is also a fallout result of the nuclear detonations. So impossible to separate the source in the case of strontium. In regard to one other purpose that the ionosphere heaters are being used for today, we believe Project Lucy, that's an acronym, and Project Alamo. The methane is already saturating the atmosphere, as I mentioned earlier, and it appears that they are now using opposing frequencies in both of these projects, Lucy and Alamo, to try to nuke the atmosphere with these opposing frequencies in a desperate attempt to try to degrade that methane. And if people Google this, Project Lucy, Project Alamo, methane release, they'll find massive scientific study on exactly what I'm talking about.
Okay, let's now bring on Scott Stevens. He's an award-winning television weatherman who investigated the claims of Lieutenant Colonel Tom Bearden about the claims that the Soviets were engineering weather over North America in the mid-70s. Scott Stevens, welcome to Coast AM.
Glad to be here this night, Rob.
I'm glad that you're joining us. You, a professional weatherman, and I wanted to bring you on because you've got some overlapping information, and I wanted to get you guys talking about this. In the earlier part of the discussion, Dane, you talked about how you felt as though Hurricane Sandy was manipulated and changed course. And, Scott, I think you've got some things to say about that from a meteorological perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. It was apparent at least 8 days out that someplace along the Mid-Atlantic coast would be dealing with a tropical storm of some strength. What we didn't know was, well, what we did know, because we could see it happening, was that there was an impulse 9 days ahead of time that came off of Siberia and was scooting through the Alaskan Aleutian Island chain. And it would be the impulse that would strengthen the trough that would eventually retard Sandy from going out into the open Atlantic and essentially fold it back in inland. And this trigger was of high interest to these flights. And you could see that just literally hundreds of these trails showing up over this impulse as it left Siberia, worked through the Aleutians back 9 days ahead of time. And so the computer models were already suggesting that there was the risk of a landfall. Some of them said no, and many said yes. And if, you know, once you we have an election coming up, we had an October surprise event, it was another big hurricane, it was a duh event for anybody who knew what was going on in the sky. They were going to use this for some kind of gain. That was just a given.
Dan, your thoughts?
I would agree with Scott. How are you, Scott?
Pretty good,
by the
way.
We
haven't talked in a while.
Scott and I know each other. I would agree with Scott completely on that, that, you know, this event, there were multiple signs, multiple signals, and there was too many anomalies to even go into. But I think if one looks at this statistically, the anomalies are beyond mathematical possibility to have been any natural occurrence.
And the thing is, it didn't have to happen. That's the thing. If you're going to engineer, you can engineer to one outcome, or you can engineer to another outcome. That coin is always on the table. And so that's where, no, there's nothing good coming from this for anybody that's probably listening tonight. Mm. And I have to agree with Dane wholeheartedly in that. Mm. As far as the agenda, what it has done, what it is doing and has done for mankind. Mm. I look at our Colorado forests, and they're a tinderbox waiting to happen. And I'm sure Dane's, when he looks out of his front yard, his and Shasta are not that much different.
Actually, Scott, I told Rob off the air tonight, three massive pyrocumulus clouds from extremely intense forest fires on the three sides of us right now. I mean, these are the most defined and highest elevation pyrocumulus I've ever seen. I mean, our forests are going up like they're soaked in napalm right now.
Yep, and you're just on the edge of this plume of this monsoon moisture, so you really don't have the high enough dew points to get, you know, a lot of water from these, what are low precipitation thunderstorms, to the forests to help out with any fires that they may trigger. You know, I had July 1st lightning strike not 3 miles from the house here, hit a tree, a ponderosa, that it was toasted by the drought, and it burned for 3 days.
Scott, something you've confirmed with me off the air as well. You're correct. Everything you said is correct. We're on the fringe, no moisture. But even when we see convective clouds forming, trying to precipitate, mm-hmm. we can see aircraft above these cells actually aerosolizing them and knocking them out so no precipitation falls. And you've seen the same phenomenon, I believe, yes?
All the time, all the time. And since they can't fly these planes, and this was one of the big things that convinced me that this activity was happening, you know, 12, 14 years ago, is I would be in eastern Idaho at 2 in the morning where there should be no commercial traffic is certainly audible to somebody standing outside. And you could hear these planes, low and slow, running through these storms. Mm. And if there's technology on board, they're using it.
Mm.
They're using it. And so in the Mountain West, you have a storm come through. The next one isn't usually right on its heels. You got to wait a week. Oh, you got to wait 10 days before the jet stream gets into that configuration where you have the next opportunity for rainfall. And if they steal 85% of the rain that would have fallen by allowing those droplets not to form, you could do it with ionization or literally this mechanical, these storms are cut halfway up. The storm will literally bend over, and what would be an anvil top is just stripped off.
Mm.
Your drops don't get big enough to fall.
Yeah.
And that lets that opportunity for that rainfall or that snowfall to just pass overhead, and you're left going, WTF. Again? Really? And that's just what we've been struggling with in the West for decades now.
Mm.
Decades.
Well, let's
make mead as low as it has been since the dam went up. And there is this agenda of drought, and that's the question, is to what end? Because California has been kept in the drought situation, and it's kind of snaked up the Cascades, but the rest of the Mountain West has done pretty darn well the last two monsoon seasons. I mean, I had a 3/4 inch of rain in 40 minutes yesterday.
Right. Well, let's hold it there, because we're going to focus on all this, Scott. But I want to say thank you to Dane Wigington for joining us for the first 2 hours. Dane, your website is geoengineeringwatch.org, which is linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com. And thanks so much for coming on and talking about this.
Thank you, Rob. Pleasure. Anytime.
Yep.
Scott, you take care.
All right. All right, everyone, stay there. When we come back, we're going to get into Scott's research as an award-winning professional meteorologist who has investigated this for quite a long time and brings a different kind of expertise to the equation. We're talking about geoengineering, weather manipulation from people who are on the inside. You're listening to Coast AM. We'll be right back after this quick break. Welcome back to Coast AM. We're talking about the weather, but not nature's weather, man's weather. an act of man. And we're talking with Scott Stevens. And Scott, tell us about your sort of mainstream weather meteorology background.
Rob, I kind of got weather in my blood when I was in the Boy Scouts. I was flipping through the merit badge booklet, and that was that weather merit badge, those requirements. Like, oh, that sounds interesting. I'll do that. And so I was 12, 13 years old, and one summer, it was July, I had to watch the evening news for 30 days consecutive, take a log of forecast, kind of the high and low, and match that with my own observations after I had built and set up a weather station. So I did that. And at the end of that 30 days, I was hooked. And from that point on, I was a weather fanatic. And I thermometers and built stations and logged. And eventually, for my Eagle Scout Award service project, I wanted to report the weather to the local TV station for my community. It wasn't an accepted thing because it didn't demonstrate leadership, but nevertheless, I had reached out to the weatherman in town, and he eventually mentored me all the way through high school. And so by the time I got to college, you know, I'd already been in TV and kind of working in the field for a few years. And so, you know, forecasting and the weather was just something that fascinated me. Mm. That and my fascination with aircraft and astronomy and the Air Force and all of those kind of aerial phenomena were just in my field all the time.
Right.
And so even before I was out of college, I was working in Topeka doing the morning weather at the ABC station. And within 10 months, I was the main guy. Mm-hmm. And from there, I went up to Omaha and worked at RFD-TV doing agricultural and pipeline and commodities forecasting, which I find fascinating because so much money is moved through the Chicago Mercantile Exchange in regards to weather,
mm-hmm.
how it impacts crop prices, orange juice futures, the ability for companies to move natural gas from Oklahoma City up to Chicago. You know, all of these things are weather dependent. And so much of every dollar that moves through this company and our countries, and indeed this world's gross domestic product, is impacted by weather.
Yeah. And how did you then sort of, looking at these weather maps, these radar maps, what was the first sort of inkling that you got that, hey, wait a second, this doesn't look natural. This could be man-made.
You know, it wasn't even then. That took a couple of years to get to that point to where I could see it in the satellite and radar imagery.
Okay.
Otherwise, it was just, you know, blobs of, it was just as it should be. I didn't know any other way. You know, there are odd things happening, but, you know, you just dealt with those as you were, you know, dealing with nowcast or severe storms or tornado warnings, and you're on the air. You see storms doing funny things, but they just do that. You don't have time to ask why. It was in reading the alternative media in the late 90s, and the word chemtrail came up. And, you know, picture of contrail out of a plane. I'm like, well, guys, well, there's enough conspiracy out there. We don't have to go into this with plane trails. Come on now.
Right.
And so I was very, very hesitant, especially when the discussion in all these stories was about toxicity. It was about killing humans. And I couldn't swallow that pill.
Right.
I couldn't. It was too much. And so, you know, the stories would come and go, and eventually, about 2003, I thought, I can figure this out. I have all the tools I need to figure this out. And so I'd come across Colonel Bearden's work, where he had said that in the wake of the Cold War, Joseph Stalin, the Russian leader, was a little freaked out by Americans' bomb-building prowess, atomic weapons and hydrogen weapons and neutron bombs and so forth. And so he told his military guys, get me something that the Americans don't have.
Mm.
What don't they have? They've got bombs. We've got bombs, but this isn't enough. We need something that supersedes what the Americans have. And so they essentially leveraged Tesla's research, Tesla's patents, Tesla's works. And so he deployed upwards of 10,000 physicists and a whole crew and came up with what was termed, according to Bearden, energetics.
Okay, let's hold it right there. Energetics, the early genesis of what we now know as weather manipulation. We'll get into that with Scott Stevens after the break. My name is Rob Simone. This is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to the show. And we're getting into the subject pretty deeply. We're talking with Scott Stevens, who is a meteorologist, someone comes from a mainstream perspective. And before the break, he was telling us how he got into weather, became a weather fanatic, ended up being a weatherman on a television, on a news, nightly morning news show. And then something, Scott, started whispering in your ear. You started hearing about these chemtrails. You start looking into it. And somehow you found the work of Lieutenant Colonel Tom Bearden. How did you come on to Tom? I say, how did you come on to Tom? Are you still there? Scott? Don't tell me you got blown away. All right, we'll try to get him back. In the meantime, let's take a quick break. We'll get Scott back on the line, and we'll see where he went. Stay right there. Yeah, you're back on Coast to Coast AM, and I hope Scott is as well. Scott, are you there?
I'm back, Rob.
Okay, good.
I'm back.
Well, you were sort of leading us into a very tantalizing story about how you went from meteorologist doing you know, television news and
regular stuff.
Yeah, and then you got onto the work of Tom Bearden and the Soviet program called Energetics.
Energetics.
Tell us about that.
Well, and according to Bearden's work, the first time this Energetics was used, and it is, to my understanding, and I know it's not complete, we're dealing with interferometry. We're sending out two beams from two different directions, and we're able to achieve action at a distance. And when you're in the interference zone of these antenna, you can either add heat or literally suck all the heat or energy or, in some cases, life out of the zone, out of the target zone. And the first time he claims that this was done was the sinking of the USS Thresher, a submarine, just after the Bay of Pigs issue and the blockade. So if the Russians had had that at that time of that Cuban Missile Crisis, the end would have been a very different deal. But when it I think that was 1963, it was until 1976 when in his world, and he was in Army intelligence, that they started using it in weather. And it was Bicentennial Week in 1976 when ham radio operators the world over in the frequencies between 3 and 30 megahertz began hearing a chirping sound. And that eventually became known as the woodpecker grid.
Mm.
And so also in 1976 to 1977, it was when the global weather just began going crazy. We had snow in Miami that next winter. The Arctic that was in the Mountain West at that time was 50, 60, 70 below zero, Colorado, Wyoming, Idaho, Montana. So we were, you know, subjected to some bizarre weathers. And that's when it all began. That's when the geoengineering began. And then Bearden's office briefed President Reagan and then that executive branch of government, because the military knew about it, but they just hadn't briefed the executive branch of government. And that didn't happen until 1984. And so from then we're like, okay, something, you know, they're playing this game against us, this silent war that we didn't know we were fighting. And from that point in time, then the Strategic Defense Initiative began, and, you know, then a whole different kind of war happened. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of when I began to be introduced in weather, was in the late 70s and 80s. So my whole career, these programs have been in operation.
Mm. I remember hearing about this woodpecker. It's this one frequency that just had this sort of chirping sound. And I didn't know that could have been related to some sort of weather manipulation technology.
Yep, nefarious. Yeah, it's mm-hmm. just that is just the byproduct of these frequencies being used, you know, and it isn't always just one frequency. It does shift.
Mm.
It does shift. It does wander around that spectrum depending on what is being used.
Yeah.
But I was still trying to figure out where these trails fit into it all. And on Bearden's website, which was chenier.org, C-H-E-N-I-E-R-E.org, there were pictures of odd patterns in clouds, altocumulus clouds, little small puffy like popcorn. You spilled a bag of popcorn on the floor, and it's what it looks like. But they were cut into grids, perfect squares. And so I was seeing in these imageries or pictures that were being shared is essentially this grid pattern, this resonance pattern that is being pushed through the atmosphere. And then I even learned more, and you get into the work of Wilhelm Reich, Oregon Energy, the chi force of this planet. And at its most basic nature is a curl or a spin, like you were to look at a pile of earthworms just kind of squirming into place. Our cumulus clouds do the same thing. They spiral. Meteorology, we're taught that things are thermodynamically living, so there's this lifted parcel. It just rises up and it bubbles. This is not so. Clouds do rise. There is a lifted condensation level, but they're always spiraling. Now, what does something that spirals creates? A current, a charge of some kind. All of the power that we are consuming outside of photovoltaics is because some generator is being turned or spun. And so these clouds are up there rotating. And this is all something you'll see when I got into time-lapse imagery. That's about another 2 years down the road. But what I was seeing in those cumulus clouds was this repeating grid or these radial patterns inside the cloud fields. And so I was trying to match what I was seeing from the ground with what I was seeing from space, or had access to the imagery from space. And those patterns would be repeated. So I'm like, oh, man, there's just this nested or infolding pattern. And it gets smaller as you get into the microscale. And when I first came on, there was a guy talking about, you know, engineering happening at the very local scale. And that is true. That is true as well as it happening on the large scale. Because the shapes and patterns they'll use on a continent-sized scale will fit inside a single thunderstorm. Those same patterns.
Hmm. Well, how did you... So you're looking at this satellite imagery, right? Mm-hmm. Is that what you're talking about? Yeah, as a meteorologist, you have access to a lot of this stuff.
And we all do, too, now with the Internet.
Well, that's true. So you're looking at these things, and you talk about the grid pattern.
Mm-hmm.
When did that start to come in, and what did you think that was?
The day the bricks fell on my head, and I had my aha moment, and never looked at weather the same, was June 6, 2004. And it was a late Sunday afternoon, you know, so the sun was setting low, 7 in the evening or so. And I was looking at Montana, and there was a weak cold front pushing from Miles City back down to Billings and then back up to Missoula, the western side of the state. Not a big event, meteorologically speaking, because I was convinced that we were dealing with hurricanes that were being manipulated. Yes, you could do large-scale droughts, but what I hadn't realized is if you're going to do big-scale events, then the little is not difficult at all, at all. And that's what this cold front laid bare to me on that day back in 2004. This cold front was sliced and diced like a loaf of, actually more like buns you would pull out of the oven. They were all domes, all ordered perfectly, one next to the other, next to the other. That can't happen. But most interestingly, over Billings, Montana, was this square cloud. And I noticed first its shadow, which was skewed off to the east because the sun was low. I'm like, holy cow, look at that square cloud. And then right back to the western side of, you know, into the cold front, maybe 150 miles to the west, there was a void in the cold front. And it was the same shape, same orientation as that square cloud over Billings. It was like it had just been picked up with a cookie cutter and put somewhere else. So that's when my realization happened, is that these pulses, these waves, this resonance, these intersecting waves are global. And they need these trails to keep these things oriented. And when you watch these planes fly across the sky, leaving the big fat trails, rarely will they be parallel to the horizon, indicating a plane in level flight.
So
how many planes have you been on cross country that are going up and down and up and down? The answer is none.
So when you saw this grid pattern, do you think that that was done from a directed energy device, or do you think that was sort of an experiment with planes leaving some sort of trail and experimenting with how they can break up a weather system?
I think the experimentation was done in the Vietnam era.
No, but with what technology?
Oh, well, they could play with cloud seeding in the beginning.
No, the grid pattern. Do you think that was done by a directed energy, or was that done by a planes using some sort of, you know, a chemical?
I think the chemicals are used for two purposes. One is powder in the sky, You can see where it's been, where it's moving, drift speed, whether it's being lifted up or being pushed down on subsidence or ascension movements in the atmosphere. You know, a couple centimeters a second is sufficient. You could determine that from space very easily with LIDAR. But that is valuable, valuable data for meteorologists. Where is the atmosphere rising and where is it descending, sinking? That is huge because that's a high and low pressures. So the powders would be used to discern those. The other thing the powders will be used for is to get an electrical grip on the sky. So you have infected it at the molecular level with a powder that a subtle EM energy can then have a huge impact upon. So you're able to juice it quite a bit more. And then when that is charged, water just runs to it. You can generate cloud cover out of 30% humidity atmosphere, something that is thermodynamically impossible. But you can do it with this stuff in the sky. And then you steal sunlight, and that goes back to Dane solar radiation management. But I think more so it's really in drawing the water.
Mm.
You're pulling the water so you can direct the storm where you want it to go.
Wow.
And for that storm to have impact on the ground below, it must be rising. And if it's rising, then that parcel of air is cooling. It's going to cool. It's going to condense it. Out comes the moisture. And if you can't pulse it from above and create or draw electrically a descending motion in the atmosphere, and you'll see this all the time. When you look at the sky, it is largely without definition. It is this gray, amorphous bank of muck. And that is a cloud, that is a storm that has been pulsed with this technology. Because the cloud definition is simply gone. They're not cirrus, they're not stratus, they're not nimbo, anything. It is just this gray bank of blank sky.
Mm.
And that's when you know they've been at work. And the precipitation potential from that cell or that zone has been greatly impacted, if not completely wiped out.
So you're looking at these grid patterns, and that was probably the beginning of you starting to question. And did you see more of them and more of these strange configurations that led you on this path to find a reason that was sort of out of the box for this stuff?
Rob, once you learn how to see, you can't not see.
Okay, well then how come many of your colleagues weren't talking?
They haven't learned to see.
Well, they're looking at this stuff, too. I mean,
they're not. Well, yes, they are. They're looking, but they're not seeing, and there's a huge difference.
So they're seeing grids and square clouds and stuff that's clearly unusual, and do they not say anything because they don't want to make waves? Is then now can we assume all weathermen are sort of part of the cover-up?
No. All I can share with you is my experience.
Hmm.
And I've had a few discussions with guys from since I'm in Colorado.
Yeah.
For a time, I was in Fort Collins. I've had access to some of the guys that work at National Centers for Atmospheric Research in Boulder.
Okay.
They're very, very compartmentalized.
Right.
They're very smart. But they also have a line that they need to sell. And this particular person that I spent probably 45 minutes with, the first 10 minutes I let him speak. Let him talk to me about his research, his job in getting the public to swallow the CO2 pill. And he's like, we're just not, you know, this is happening. It's our responsibility. You know, the climate change is the carbon dioxide. Come on now, guys. Why can't we get this message to stick? You know, what's going on? And I'm like, well, what about global warming? And he's like, yes, this is the cause. Next question. What about the contrails? What about all of the clouds created by the contrails? He's like, ooh, good question. He said, you know, about every 5 years, I go back and look at the papers. I go back and look at the research on cirrus clouds, thermal management, how it is impacting the weather and the climate, more importantly. And his conclusion, and this is, of course, just, you know, his personal conclusion, was that it would actually aid in the planet's warming. And I said, well, let me show you some pictures. And I went to grab my camera. And we spent the next 30 minutes looking through the past 2 months of movies, planes, full wingspan trails, patterns, repeating patterns. I had done some screenshots off of the computer, and he was just floored, absolutely and utterly floored. And he looked at me white-faced and said, we're not briefed on any of this. We're not briefed on this.
Mm.
And so it had an impact on him. And until you're willing to step out of the box and be semi-courageous to even consider the fact that these may be true, then you're never going to see it. It's not going to happen. And so, Rob, this is why I'm changing from Weather Wars to the Real Weather Show. And I've launched this Indiegogo crowdfunding thing because what I want to do is set up 50 cameras or camera in every single state, more in Colorado because that's where I am and I know more people here, and feed this back to this central, to this show, and get in front of high-definition cameras, a green screen, and explain what's happening, how they're using these technologies to literally move 1, 2, 3, 4,000-foot-thick layer of the atmosphere in a completely different direction than the ones above it and below it.
Do we know who they are?
Only they who can afford it. You know, who is allowed unfettered access to our skies? Who can buy 200-300 planes a year, paint them up to look like FedEx, UPS, Southwest, United, British Airways, you know, all of those planes? If you have permission to fly cargo in our skies, you essentially have been browbeaten into submission to allow either your pay scheme or your planes to participate in the program. It's just that simple. And they will kill to keep it as it is.
Hmm.
They will kill.
Well, how do you know that?
Because we're 40 years in and we can't get traction. We can't get traction. And those that are in the military that do come out and talk about this are immediately harassed. And the only reason I'm allowed to talk about this is because I haven't signed any disclosure agreements or anything with any other company. I have done all of this on my own, and I have not done anything that any other meteorologist that worked for any radio, TV, or cable outlet couldn't have done had they displayed the curiosity, the courage, and the fortitude to follow through on a simple investigation. I put up cameras around the house. I bought 2 computers, 4 cameras, and some time-lapse software and figured it out.
Hmm.
All of these TV stations have these cameras, too. Use them.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned earlier that the Soviet Union, back in the late 70s, started up this program, Energetics. They, in your words, they wanted something that America didn't have. So are you saying that really it was the Soviet Union who started developing this technology first?
Tesla had it first.
Tesla did. So,
and then whatever the FBI did or did not get of his materials, of his invention, the day after he passed, we don't know.
Hmm.
Because the Russians were there, too. Both were exceedingly interested, and that is a thriller of a book.
Hmm.
You know, the year around and after Tesla's death. Because they all knew he was brilliant, and he had to be marginalized. Otherwise, we would have free power, and you and I could meet for lunch tomorrow on Mars.
Hmm. Did the Soviet Union, to your knowledge, ever use this technology in a very visible way that we know about?
Well,
or that we think?
If Bearden is correct, then the USS Thresher was sunk, and that was a submarine. And I'm not convinced that the Challenger and Columbia shuttle shootdowns or accidents weren't exactly those. They were shootdowns.
Whoa, you're saying someone... Yeah. Did that on purpose?
They were shootdowns. Shootdowns, plain and simple. And I've got the picture of the lightning strike that hit Challenger over California. There was an MD that was out doing astronomy. He had he was shooting the reentry of Challenger.
Hmm.
And got the picture of the lightning strike. And NASA told me never to publish that again.
Well, hold it right there. I had no idea we'd be diving into this kind of subject matter, but you never know where the information is going to lead, and we're going to go down the rabbit hole as far as it takes. We're talking about geoengineering and this very exotic technology. Our guest is Scott Stevens. His website is weatherwars.info. It's linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com. Stay right there. You're listening to Coast to Coast AM, and we'll be right back.